Hi, we're Josh
and Arielle Wamsley,
owners of Green Valley Tree LLC, based in North Windham.
We're proud to sponsor Connecticut East this week and to serve the communities of Windham and New London counties with our tree removal and plant healthcare services.
Visit our website at greenvalleytreeworks.com for a full list of our services or give us a call on 860-234-4041. We look forward to hearing from you.
Concerns over CVS and Walgreens vaccinating those in long-term care, pharmacy benefit managers and rebates, and a cheaper electricity bill thanks to sweeping changes by the state's Public Utilities Regulatory Authority. Plus a look at other stories making the headlines from around the region. This is Connecticut East This Week. Hello, I'm Brian Scott Smith. We've discussed before the cost of medication and healthcare in this country and how it's costing all of us a small fortune, while huge corporations rake in millions, even billions of dollars in profits each year as a result. But is the tide starting to turn? We'll be discussing those issues with Ronna Hauser from the National Community Pharmacists Association, but we kick off that interview with recent concerns from local pharmacists across the nation over CVS and Walgreens' ability to vaccinate those in long-term care facilities and the challenges this is bringing. Ronna, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. It's good to be here today.
Now, long-term care pharmacists are expressing concerns with CVS and Walgreens with regards to the delivery of the COVID-19 vaccines, which have recently been approved by the FDA for nursing homes. Why is that?
Our members that serve long-term care facilities began to show concern over the last several weeks about the ability of the two national chains to solely deliver the vaccine to nursing facilities and congregate care homes, including assisted living facilities. The first thing we started to hear a few weeks ago was that independent pharmacies, pharmacists, long-term care pharmacists, and pharmacy owners were being recruited themselves by the chains to assist in the effort. So our members began having concerns about possible staffing shortages. And then our members also were concerned with the messaging that the national chains were sending into the facilities. Our members are in those facilities providing pharmacy services every day, so they have a good rapport with the facilities and the facility staff. And some of the messaging from the chains, it really showed a lack of understanding about operations and, you know, day-to-day operations of a facility and what might be the best approaches to performing administration of the vaccine. So coupled with the concerns of staffing and the concerns with a lack of understanding about the needs of the facilities, we conducted a survey recently and released results.
I suppose one of the things to say is obviously CVS and Walgreens are great, you know, chain pharmacies that you can go visit. Is that part of the problem? You know, we're talking here about people who may not have, mobility or may have mobility issues, you know, have particular needs. Is that also part of the concern here?
I think from our survey results, you know, you'll see that the main concerns, as I mentioned, were the staffing and adequate staffing to provide the vaccine on clinic days in the facilities. And then again, just some general possible misunderstanding of the best approaches and the best pathway to work with a facility to provide the vaccine to its residents. You know, these are patients who are not mobile, who may not be able to leave their rooms to line up, you know, for a vaccine clinic. That might be something that's more akin to what the chain pharmacies are used to offering within the communities themselves. So again, just making sure that the conversations between the pharmacies and the homes, everyone understands what's needed and can perform those services. I will say that because of the concerns we've heard, we do know that the CDC and states are looking into bringing more independent pharmacies into the fold for phase one to assist the national chains in that effort.
Also, I believe the survey showed, you know, a response from the nursing homes as well. Obviously, you know, they were concerned because I'm guessing they work most of the time with, you know, these independent local pharmacies. And this seems to be sort of like something that's being put upon them because it's something that's been nationally agreed.
Yeah, absolutely. By and large, nearly half of the long-term care market is cared for pharmacy services are cared for by local independent owned pharmacies. So the facilities would not be used to working with the two large national chain partners on a day-to-day basis, like they are, you know, our members. So it would be a major change for them.
And quick final point on there, you said that you're hearing that maybe the CDC and the states, you know, will sort of like review this. Is there anything maybe that independent local pharmacies can do? Or is it a case of just, you know, hanging tight and see what plays out on this?
Well, our members have been able to sign federal partnerships with the CDC to administer the vaccine. The majority of those federal partnerships center on phase two and beyond. But again, we are, you know, aware that there will be gaps that need to be filled, that the large national chains cannot. And that's where, you know, we understand our members will play a role. So they should be working through the partners that they signed the federal agreement with. And then they should also be active at their state level. You know, a lot of these decisions are being made by the state and local health departments where our members are plugged in as well. So we want to assist wherever we can. We want to make sure that the facilities are being, you know, cared for, the residents are being cared for appropriately throughout this entire process. So we stand ready to assist in those efforts.
It's a big undertaking at the end of the day. So there was always bound to be some sort of like little hiccup. So hopefully, as you said, you know, those things can be ironed out quickly because it's so important to get the COVID-19 vaccines out there. Now they've been given FDA's emergency use clearance. I want to move on to a couple of other subjects because there's so much going on in the healthcare field at the moment. And I want, we've spoken about it before with your organization. So I just want to like get some updates on this. One of them was a landmark decision fairly recently with regards to pharmacy benefit managers and the state of Arkansas. Tell us about that because it's huge.
It is very huge. Last week, Independent Pharmacy had a very good day with the Supreme Court decision, an 8-0 unanimous decision in favor of the state of Arkansas and against PCMA, which is the lobbying organization for the pharmacy benefit managers. So I like to say it was a great day for Independent Pharmacy and a very bad day for the PBM lobby and the PBMs themselves. So it was a long fought battle with many pharmacy partners, but we are very grateful to the state of Arkansas and their fight, you know, to allow common sense regulation and oversight of pharmacy benefit managers at the state level. So we see this as a very big step in the next direction, which is increased oversight, increased transparency, increased regulation of pharmacy benefit managers.
And do we know when that sort of kicks in? It's great to obviously get this ruling. It's, as we said, it's landmark. It's a big step in the right direction. But do we know when that will all start to kick in?
States right now are gearing up for their upcoming legislative sessions. Of course, some will look different than others, depending on locale and decisions at the state level as to how the legislature should proceed. But we, you know, we're active in all states, and Independent Pharmacy is active lobbying in all states on behalf of, you know, their small businesses and their patients. So gearing up for the next legislative sessions and, you know, making sure that laws that have been passed previously that attempt to regulate PBMs, make sure they're followed through on appropriately and accordingly, and make sure that it's very clear that PBMs cannot hide behind the ERISA exemption anymore. The Supreme Court made clear that ERISA cannot exempt, you know, the ability of a state to oversee and regulate the relationship between PBMs and pharmacies.
And just so that we're absolutely clear on this, obviously, whenever we hear things like this, it's always great news. But then, of course, we then hear, oh, but this, you know, organization will, you know, seek to obviously try to have that overturned or whatever. What's the situation here? Is this a done deal, or could the PBMs or like organizations attempt to have this overturned?
You know, we do view this as a done deal as far as what was at stake in the Arkansas, you know, argument and the ability of the state to oversee rate regulation between PBMs and pharmacies should not be a question anymore. So as I mentioned, we will be, you know, definitely fighting at the state level to strengthen laws that are already in existence and then to, you know, bring forth new laws in order to further our cause, which is, again, to maintain the viability of small business community pharmacies and to also help our patients and help our patients have choice and help our patients have the lowest cost drugs at the pharmacy of their choice.
That segues quite nicely into the last thing that I want to talk to you about. Fairly recently, there was a new final rule on prescription drug rebates that was pushed through by the current administration. However, you and other organizations say not good enough. Why not?
No, we think that the thought of passing through the secret backdoor deals between the manufacturers and PBMs to the patients so they see real savings is very important. the overall goal is extremely important. However, being that the rebate rule is applicable to the Medicare Part D program, there is a very large problem for pharmacies in the Part D program today, and that's retroactive fees that are assessed long after a prescription has left a pharmacy. And we refer to these as direct and indirect remuneration fees, and they are on average or $100,000 in retroactive fees per pharmacy that's paid back to PBMs. So that was not addressed in the final rebate rule. So we definitely see that as a very large concern moving forward with any implementation of that rule.
So really, this was a rather toothless piece of sort of like legislation then?
Well, it is a rule that I do feel will have very far-reaching impacts on our industry. And pharmacy is absolutely going to play a role and be involved in, you know, the outcome of this rule. If it does actually go into effect in 2022, we shall see with the new administration and what direction they take. But it will absolutely impact pharmacies, and pharmacies are an integral part of the supply chain. And there's a lot of very technical information in that rule that will flow down and through pharmacies. So I would say it's not toothless. It is important for us to be tracking that rule and to be working with industry partners to make sure it's implemented correctly and that there's not any ill effects on community pharmacy from that rule itself. But and again, the rule did not address DIR fees, and we feel that that's going to be one area where the PBMs might just get more and more aggressive, especially if they're not able to play the rebate rule game anymore.
We know that your organization and obviously other organizations are very hot on making sure that, you know, these issues stay in not only in the public eye, but obviously in the eye of legislators. Bearing in mind, as you say, a new legislative session will be starting in January. We have a new president and legislation that will be in effect as of January 20th. I take it that you will be moving forward with your partners to try and get the new administration to review this, not just this rule, but obviously, as you say, the other fees that you mentioned, to try and get a fairer deal and to keep these pharmacies in business.
Absolutely. You know, we're in active dialogue with the transition team, and we look forward to working with the new administration to make sure these rules are implemented, according to plan, and make sure that DIR fees go away. That's our ultimate goal. $100,000 per year paid back to a PBM after the drugs have left the pharmacy is a very unfair advantage. And, our members are trying to provide the best level of service in their communities across the country. And when they go up against very large conglomerate, vertically integrated healthcare companies, it can make it very difficult unless there's a level playing field.
Rhonna Hauser from the National Community Pharmacists Association, as always, thank you for clarifying these points with us and letting us understand the healthcare arena as it continues to evolve. We look forward to speaking with you and the National Community Pharmacists Association in the future on other stories. But in the meantime, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Happy to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
This year saw huge increases in everyone's electricity bills from Eversource and United Illuminating, two of the largest power companies in Connecticut. The increases were for the delivery portion of our bills, not the actual amount of electricity we all used. That said, the delivery increases took many by surprise and led to the state's Public Utilities Regulatory Authority, or PURA, to begin an investigation into them. The investigation is now complete, and PURA, who has legislative powers to make changes in the state, has rendered its decision, and it's a win for the consumer, as Marissa Gillette, chairman of PURA, discussed with me recently. Marissa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
So PURA released a press release saying that you're making sweeping changes to electric rate adjustment process following an investigation into a July bill increase, which caused a bit of a storm earlier this year. In a nutshell, what does it actually all mean?
Great question. So the announcement that we made today, which was followed by a formal decision for both Eversource and UI, resets the framework by which we evaluate and approve rate adjustments for the delivery portion of a customer's bill. So specifically, these are the items on your bill that recover public policy costs and other costs that are mandated by either state or federal government. So by changing the framework in which we evaluate these costs, we're hoping to provide more stability, transparency, and really just education about when those costs are going to hit and what you can expect from them. So we've also made some additional changes to do that. One meaningful change is that we have changed the carrying costs that utilities can collect for these line items. It's going from a rate of approximately 7 to 9% down to the prime interest rate, which is currently 3.25%. And we've also ordered both utilities to participate in a comprehensive redesign of customer electric bills. So I think those are the primary takeaways, and we're hoping that it provides a measure of accountability and increased transparency into what PURA does and how our utilities respond.
The other question I want to put to you, Marissa, is we did recently, I believe, see an approved rate increase by PURA for electricity bills. So what happened there? I mean, will that be affected? Will that be reviewed? Or were you happy with what was presented by the utility companies when you approved that rate increase?
Yeah, great question, because I think that gets to the heart of the matter. The revised rates that we announced a couple weeks back were for the supply portion of the customer's bill. So Connecticut is one of many states in the country that deregulated your energy supply back in the 90s. And what that means is PURA and the utilities, we no longer regulate that portion of your bill. So we can oversee an auction to ensure that the utilities are purchasing the least cost energy, but those prices are set by the wholesale, the regional wholesale market. So we don't have control over what those are at. They are the result of a auction process that happens twice a year. So that announcement of the rates that are increasing for the supply portion of your bill on January 1, that's actually routine. The rates for your supply always, always, always go up in January, and they go down always in July. And that is a reflection of the fact that it costs more to produce energy in the winter months as compared to the summer months. So there's more analysis on PURA's website about that, a more comprehensive explanation. And the good news here is that the rates for the supply portion, although they're going up compared to what they are now, they're actually going up to a lesser degree than they have in previous winter months. So unfortunately, those supply rates of your bill, that decision stands. We've done as much as we can there within the confines of our current jurisdiction, and it's unaffected by today's ruling.
One thing that has come up in the past during all of this, and certainly it's been put forward by Senator Blumenthal quite strongly, is he felt that companies like Eversource, sort of the market or Eversource itself, should be broken down because it's far too big and therefore it's not really in the public interest. And there was a suggestion that maybe more sort of regional power companies, should exist in Connecticut. Connecticut does have a few of them already dotted around the state. Do you, what's your reaction to that, and would that make any difference at all?
It's certainly an interesting proposition. I received those comments from the senator. Others have been echoing them. And my reaction has been that everything should be on the table at this point in time. I think that that might be a more appropriate conversation in our storm investigation, because the regionalization of utilities, that has more bearing, in my opinion, on some of the reactions or the responses to storms and other events that you see there. Today's decision is really dealing with the public policy drivers and the costs associated with those. It would make a difference regionalizing utilities, like creating more co-ops or regional Connecticut utilities, but not in the way that people think. Right now, the way the laws are structured, the regional co-ops don't pay their share of those public policy costs. They're only distributed and recovered from customers of Eversource and UI. And that can be significant because about 6% of our load right now is represented by those smaller regional co-ops, which can be one of the major distinctions between rates that you're paying as an Eversource UI customer versus those smaller co-ops. And I think to understand why those smaller utilities don't pay for public policy costs is a question best posed to the legislature.
Do you feel that you're actually like using your teeth a little bit more than you have in the past? Because it seems from reading the press release that, some of this is histrionics, that it's happened over periods of time and now you're addressing it. You are, of course, a new chairman to PURA. I mean, is this a case of you're now so like you're putting your foot down?
I feel that way. I've read in some spaces that, folks feel that I'm definitely putting my foot down. And whether you think that that's a good thing or a bad thing, I think depends on who you are in this equation, right? But that's certainly my intent. I think that was the governor's intent too, in bringing me up from another state. You know, sometimes getting a fresh set of eyes and revisiting how things have been done for 10 or 15 years isn't a bad thing. I mean, maybe they were being done that way for a good reason, but if you can't articulate that reason to me and all you can say to me is, well, we shouldn't change because we've always done it that way, then I think it's exactly the time to change. So I think that you're going to see more of this. This is the first resolution to one of the many investigations PURA has underway. And I expect to exercise the authority that the legislature has granted PURA to the fullest extent.
One of the other things that people will be asking is, you know, apart from seeing hopefully slightly cheaper electricity bills, you know, that sort of comment that there has been around for a long time that Connecticut residents pay some of the most expensive electricity in the United States. Are we now going to see through PURA and through, you know, changes like this, Connecticut residents getting a fairer deal when it comes to their electricity?
That's a great question. I think that through actions like today, Connecticut residents will understand better why they are paying higher electricity rates. I think, you know, Connecticut has a lot of laudable goals and that have been enacted, you know, by our legislature, and they're being paid for through customers' electric rates. And, you know, your bill doesn't reflect the benefits of, you know, the societal benefits and other things like that of those public policy costs. But it creates an unfair comparison to other states who haven't enacted public policies like that. So today's decision, which is going to drive more transparency into what a customer is paying for, when and why, will at least allow them to have an apples to apples comparison of rates being charged in Connecticut versus the surrounding states.
A final question to you, Chairman Gillette, and thank you ever so much for your time. Other than what we've just discussed, what takeaway message do you want to leave the listeners with about, you know, what you have and what PURA has enacted today?
The takeaway message I'd love customers and, you know, ratepayers across Connecticut to understand is that your voice did matter. Taking a hard look at the rate making process in Connecticut was always, it's been on my radar since I came in early 2019, but the reactions over the summer, you know, moved this closer to the top of the list. You know, PURA as a quasi-judicial agency can only make decisions based on the evidence that's put before it. So I really encourage folks to stay engaged and to reach out to PURA with questions and comments and to contact the Office of Consumer Counsel and really just to stay as engaged as you can moving forward, because that's the way that decisions are going to better reflect a balance between the risk associated with rates being borne equitably between ratepayers and utility shareholders. So, you know, that's what I'd like to leave them with is we listened and we're trying to make adjustments and look forward to continuing those conversations.
Marissa Gillette, Chairman of PURA, thanks ever so much for the interview today.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Green Valley Tree LLC is proud to sponsor Connecticut East This Week. Contact Green Valley Tree LLC for all your tree removal and plant health care needs and more. Find us at greenvalleytreeworks.com or call 860-234-4041.
Time now for a look at some of the other stories making the headlines in the region recently. The Connecticut Port Authority held its first public hearing in almost 2 years. The meeting was held remotely due to COVID-19 restrictions and drew sharp criticism from several speakers, including authority critic Kevin Blacker from NOANC and Chris Frixel, the president of the Associated Builders and Contractors Trade Association. Mike Passero, the mayor of the City of New London, also spoke at the hearing about State Pier that has been taken over by the CPA for possible future offshore wind projects, and Passero didn't hold back his unhappiness with the authority.
There have been a series of egregious broken promises to the City of New London that has resulted, unfortunately, in a strained relationship between the authority and the city for the past 2 years now. This is not constructive for the authority, the city, or the state.
CPA representatives gave no response to comments put to them, but did say they would consider all the comments and report back on them in their January meeting of board members. In the Connecticut Examiner this week, the Eastern Regional Tourism District announced that it would distribute a total of $152,267 in grant money to 9 partnerships that are developing marketing campaigns to promote local tourism. The selected campaigns include the Airline Trail, the Thames River Heritage Park, the Greater Mystic Chamber of Commerce, and efforts to promote tourism through partnerships in Voluntown, Wyndham, New London, Norwich, and Old Lyme. 2 other organizations, Old Mystic Village and the Last Green Valley, each received $25,000 in October, increasing the total amount of grant money distributed to over $200,000. In the day this week, Lawrence and Memorial Hospital in New London vaccinated 3 of its frontline workers with the COVID-19 vaccine recently, joining hospitals across the state and the country in a campaign aimed at ending the pandemic. Kate Graves, an advanced practice registered nurse, received the first injection, followed by Donna Whitehouse, a patient care assistant, and Dawn Kirk, who works in the food and nutrition department. Graves said she and a friend, who is a co-worker, have been working on a COVID-19 unit since the pandemic began. Whitehouse said she got the vaccine in the hopes that it would enable her to more frequently visit a grandson she's been unable to see as much as she'd like. In the Norwich Bulletin this week, as 2020 comes to a close, many businesses are still struggling due to the pandemic. As the Greater Norwich Area Chamber of Commerce and the Norwich Community Development Corporation held their virtual legislative forum, businesses had the opportunity to share their concerns with both local Democratic and Republican members of the State House and Senate. Rebecca Alberts, co-owner of These Guys Brewing in Norwich, told legislators and fellow business owners about her struggles during the pandemic. She said she, along with her co-owner husband Ray Alberts, haven't taken a paycheck in 4 months and have been using up their personal savings to keep the brew pub going. Even with their sacrifices, Alberts said they had to let go 16 of the 24 employees they had prior to the pandemic. Alberts inquired whether there could be a stay on business evictions. There has been an eviction moratorium for residential renters, which is currently set to end at the end of the month. In the Chronicle this week, Wyndham Community Memorial Hospital officials have been dispersing the COVID-19 vaccine doses they received recently. The state received an initial 31,000 doses of the Pfizer vaccine and will also be receiving vaccine from Moderna. Now the FDA has approved its use as well. Under the state's mass vaccination plan, doses will be distributed as follows. Phase 1A is expected to last into mid-January and will include healthcare workers, nursing home residents, and medical first responders. Phase 1B, which is expected to run from mid-January to late May, will include critical workforce, other congregate settings, adults 65 years and older, and anyone considered high risk who is younger than 65. Phase 2, which is expected to begin in early June, will include anyone under 18 years old, as well as remaining residents over the age of 18. 2 doses of the vaccine are required for it to be effective. And in next week's Connecticut East this week, 2020 has been an extraordinary year, all because of COVID-19. It has reshaped all our lives, from the way we work to how we educate our children and more, and has dominated the news headlines. We'll be talking to the Eastern Connecticut-based online news outlet, the Connecticut Examiner, and its staff, who have reported on these stories to get their take on which ones have struck a chord with them and why, and to look back at some of the stories we've probably already forgotten. That's all from us for this edition. Do send us your questions and story ideas to the show via our website at connecticut-east.com or Facebook or Twitter at Connecticut East, where you can also listen to the show again on demand. And please like, follow, and share on your social media platforms too. I'm Brian Scott Smith. Thank you for listening.